I want to cover some remaining topics here in this last audio, first with a look at your insurance cards. I usually like to play another game, put your cards on the table, because so many people we've counseled or spoken to don't really know what they have. I don't blame them. Where do you learn this stuff? So on page 15 of the presentation PDF, you'll see five cards, and the one on the top left is the Medicare card. It has your name, your number, which is a random string of letters and numbers, and it tells you the date you started getting Part A and or Part B. A word of caution about the Medicare card. Even though it no longer has your Social Security number on it, the scammers have developed some new tricks, of course. Medicare is not giving out replacement cards. You'd have to log into your secure account and print out a replacement one for yourself, or call them up and ask them to send you a new one. So I don't have to tell you to hang up the phone on anyone telling you that you need a new card for this year, or worse, that you're going to get a fine if you don't reorder one from them. To the right of that is a sample Medigap card. It has the company's name, the kind of plan it is, in this case an F, your member ID, name, and effective date. Simple, clean. All this card does is pick up the rest of the costs that Medicare is not paying for, depending on the type of plan you bought. You give the Medicare card and the Medigap card to your providers, and they'll send the paperwork through to the right places. On the top right is a prescription drug card. Again, simple like the Medigap card. This one goes to the pharmacist. And at the bottom left corner is the Medicare Advantage card, which is packed with information. You can't mistake this for anything else but a complete dinner menu. It has the name of the company, of course, and the type of plan it is, like an HMO in this case. It gives the network you're in, the PCP, that's the primary care physician, their telephone number and copay, and also a copay for specialists, emergency room, and the pharmaceutical costs. Usually there's a big RX somewhere on this card, which indicates that the plan includes prescription drugs. I've put this last one here for Blue Cross Blue Shield in case you run into it. They use little suitcase logos, or none at all, to indicate the kind of coverage they're giving you. There's actually more suitcases there than I show, so you have to look them up online for the various kinds of HMOs, PPOs, and other types of plans that they offer. No logo at all means it's a Medigap, or for people on Medicaid. Since I drew up these charts a few years ago, there have been some changes, as with all cards. So just Google Blue Cross Blue Shield suitcase logo, and you'll see a 16-page document on them, believe it or not. The last screen in the presentation PDF is devoted to bits and pieces, which I want to go through as quickly as possible. Appeals and grievances, that's the first one. There's a difference. You file an appeal when you're not getting the service or the prescription drug you think you need, even when it's not in the literature that it's being offered. Filing an appeal has always been pretty simple. The rules were laid out in the handbook and online. But unfortunately, just as I'm recording this audio, I get an email about new integrated appeals and grievances protocol, which I haven't looked into yet at all. Hopefully, it's even simpler than before. But I haven't explored the changes or when they'll start if they haven't already. Appeals have always taken some time to play out, as the back and forth between you and your plan and your doctor or pharmacist, that's for the backup documentation, is a lengthy process, depending, of course, whether the plan just wants to give up fighting you early on in the process. Keep in mind who has the most stake in the profits of these companies. Is it you, the patient, or the stockholders? In any case, keep trying. Develop a harder skin than you think you have, because you're up against a massive industry with its own survival instincts, and you sometimes have to go against your own desire to be nice. This is pure business, and appeals can go way up into the court system. Grievances are something else. That's when you want to complain about an issue, like the way the doctor or the plan operates. When you file a grievance, and it can be done verbally, you're triggering an incident, and there's protocols for resolving these. I write grievances all the time because I have a lot of experience with what seniors should expect from their medical practitioners at this point in their lives when they're perhaps not so comfortable on the computer or negotiating telephone options, which, by the way, are frequently designed not by the office workers themselves, but by corporate tech people, some with no hands-on experience. By filing a grievance, I feel I'm speaking for others who can't or won't bother doing it for themselves. For example, I have a personal peeve against technology taking over and running our lives, particularly when it's so inefficient from the patient's point of view. And I don't always file grievances first. I mostly call the office manager to tell them I gripe and explain where this particular procedure they're doing is just not good enough for us. Generally, they're responsive and fix things. I go to grievance more for policies, like when I get a call out of the blue from some office person asking if I want a visiting nurse to come over and talk to me about my health needs. That, to me, is outrageous. I didn't give this outside organization my health information. The plan did, and shame on them. And secondly, how dare they? For me, this is a pure erosion of HIPAA rules and something terribly grievable. Not that this has helped, but I'm hoping that if they hear from a lot of us, they'll take it more seriously. 2. The donut hole. When the law was put into place in 2006 for Part D, people who were taking a lot of medicines discovered that after a certain monetary point in the year, when the cost of their drugs reached a certain amount, the insurance companies weren't going to pay anymore. That was crazy, and many people went bankrupt. So the government had to fix this so-called gap in coverage where the plan wasn't paying anything, and they did that by setting a dollar figure that you needed to reach before falling into this coverage gap, and then they figured out a way to help you with your drug costs once you were stranded inside it while the plans were calling a timeout. It took a number of years to lower the percentages of what you'd be responsible for the generics and for the brand name drugs. But by 2020, that percentage matched what you had been paying in your initial coverage period before you entered the gap. And what was that amount? Well, you pay 25% of your drug costs, and the plan is supposed to be paying 75%. Here's where it starts to get weird, because there is a standard arrangement for cost sharing inside that initial coverage period, and then there is reality. In the so-called standard arrangement, once the threshold is met and you slid into the so-called gap, the 75% that you won't be paying for will be paid for in different ways. For generics, the plan will pick up that 75% you're not paying for. For brand name drugs, though, they'll only pick up 5%. For the rest, they've arranged that the costs will be covered by a manufacturer discount. So the plans are not paying the bulk of the cost for the brand name drugs in the gap amounts. It's the manufacturer which is reducing their prices. And this is a great example of what happens when lobbyists have so much influence in Washington. The strange kink here is something I just learned from the National Council on Aging. And they say that most Part D plans are not standard plans. And this means that calculating the cost of your drugs during the initial coverage period varies by plan. And in fact, very little in the plan finders resembles the standard design. You'll see a lot of varying percentages and an equal number of instructions to just call the plan. If you truly take a lot of medications, you might very well reach another threshold, which takes you out of the coverage gap and puts you into the last phase, catastrophic coverage, where the costs really go way down. You'll pay up to 5% of the drug. The plan picks up 15%, and it's the government that picks up the remaining 80%. So you can see that this section of the year between the two thresholds, this gap in coverage, is what people call the donut hole. Another weird part about the calculations is that what counts to get you into the gap is not the same list of things that gets you out of it, into that catastrophic coverage. You go into the coverage gap when you and your plan have paid a total of $4,660. Most people don't go higher than that amount. The threshold to get out of the donut hole and into the catastrophic part, which is the cheapest coverage that lasts until the end of the year, is $7,400 in 2023. That figure is the sum of quite a few things. It includes your deductible, what you paid during the initial coverage period, almost the full cost of the brand name drugs you got during the coverage gap, including the manufacturer's discount, any amounts paid by others on your behalf, and any amounts paid by assistance programs. Costs that are never included in this second catastrophic threshold are your monthly premiums, the small amount that your plan paid in the gap, drugs not covered by Medicare or by out-of-network pharmacies, and that 75% remainder for generics. You do not have to keep track of this. The plan does. And some retiree plans don't even have these thresholds for going in or out of the coverage gap because their pricing structures work differently throughout the year. So you can look at your explanation of benefits for clarification, and it may say there that there is no coverage gap at all in your particular plan. Of course, this goes annually, so this whole process starts over again at the beginning of the new year. I want to mention now the new for-profit effort in the Medicare industry that's causing even more dismay than the profit motives of the Advantage plans. The Advantage plans have recently made news because of the way I want to mention the new for-profit effort in the Medicare industry that's causing even more dismay than the profit motives of the Advantage plans. The Advantage plans have recently made news because of the way they've been pulling more per capita funding from the government by claiming some patients are sicker than they really are. Well, a program called Direct Contracting began under the Trump administration, and its current almost identical iteration is called ACO Reach. This is also somewhat suspect. Here are the three things that are causing people a lot of concern. First of all, Medicare Advantage plans are allowed to use about 15% of incoming dollars for profit and administration. These new ACO Reach entities are allowed to use up to 40%, and that means they're only required to spend 60% on healthcare. Secondly, if your doctor or group signs up with a DC or a REACH organization, you will be transferred into it automatically without your full understanding or consent. You won't be able to opt out of this unless you change your primary doctor. And lastly, there aren't any limits on the type of company that can become an ACO REACH entity. They don't need the consent of Congress or of Medicare. For example, your doctor may find himself in a situation where the plan is run by a hedge fund. I know people already who have received letters from one medical group here in Westchester saying that they're going to be transferred into a direct contracting structure. It's troublesome. CMS put out a booklet last September on Medicare's mental health benefits. You can Google that. And they put out another one for ambulance coverage a little bit earlier in 2022. You can Google that one also. If you have an issue with Medicare services, you can call the Livanta helpline, L-I-V-A-N-T-A. That helpline is at 866-815-5440. It's the Quality Improvement Organization in New York State responsible for medical case review, and it works to make sure you get the services that are required by law. You might call them, for example, if you feel you're being discharged from a hospital too soon. That will probably get you an extra 24 hours to make your arrangements for a safe release. Medicare is actually going to pay for that. Again, their number is 866-815-5440. And another program to know about is the Senior Medicare Patrol. That works to prevent and report Medicare fraud and waste, and you can Google them. They have a good helpline. I just realized that I haven't talked about star ratings, which is the way Medicare measures how well the Advantage plans and the Part D plans perform. They're rated in categories like quality of care, customer service, and assigned an overall rating as well, from 1 to 5 stars in the fall. You can see these ratings in the online plan finder through Medicare.gov, but to tell you the truth, ratings aren't really at the top of my list for consideration. But you might want to give some real thought to a plan with fewer than 3 stars. And it's also interesting to note that once a year, you're allowed to use a special enrollment period to switch to a 5-star plan from the one you're currently enjoying, if you can find one of these in your area. Call Medicare to make the change if you need to. The pink box on the last page in the presentation PDF mentions Medicare and COVID. But since we're coming out of the public health emergency at this point, the situation is really fluid. There are links there that you can Google for ongoing changes to the regulations and protocols. That useful telephone numbers box links to a list I've compiled for getting help. Side 1 is for medical issues, and side 2 is for other kinds of senior services. Feel free to use the email addresses on the bottom of this page to ask us questions, or give us a call. We steep ourselves in Medicare, and if we can't answer something right away, we're more than happy to do some research and get back to you.